collapse into a black hole after a merger. If a neutron star did survive, it tells us about under what conditions a neutron star can exist. Finding a baby magnetar would be exciting, says astrophysicist Omsharan Salafia of Italy's National Institute for Astrophysics in Marata, Italy, who was not involved in the new research. A newborn, highly magnetized, highly rotating neutron star that forms from the merger of two neutron stars has never been observed before, he says. But he agrees that it's too soon to rule out other explanations. What's more, recent computer simulations suggest that it might be difficult to see a newborn magnetar even if it is formed, he says. I wouldn't say this is settled. Observing how the object's light behaves over the next 4 months to 6 years, Fung and her colleagues have calculated will prove whether or not a magnetar was indeed born.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. Your host, Saeed Puriza, here. We begin in the UK, where hospitals are treating more COVID-19 patients now than at the peak of the first wave in spring. More than 20,000 patients are currently on oxygen or ventilators, with numbers set to rise following the Christmas period when people flock to malls and shopping centers to buy presents and meeting with family members. Murtaza Jaffer takes a closer look at the British National Health Service comes under significant strain.
We're back in the eye of the storm. These were the words of Simon Stevens, the head of Britain's National Health Service, as more people are in hospital with COVID-19 now than at the peak of the first wave earlier this year. Authorities are blaming the soaring infection rates on a new, more transmissible variant of the virus, first identified in southeast England. Dr. Katie Sanderson of the Doctors Association has warned that the strain on hospitals is only going to get worse.
The volume of sick patients coming in with coronavirus is verging on unmanageable, just in terms of ambulance capacity, A&E capacity and bed capacity. We haven't seen the patients who had coronavirus infections that they've contracted over Christmas yet, because they're probably not sick enough to come to hospital yet.
Ambulances with infected patients have been forced to wait outside hospitals as capacity is overstretched. Many more infected individuals are forced to wait at home as ambulances are unable to meet the demands on the system.
This is something that we've just never experienced before. Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
A growing number of National Health Service staff are also off work because they are self-isolating or have become sick with the virus. Officials are now considering tightening coronavirus restrictions, with some suggesting a total nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the new strain. Britain has recorded more than 71,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, although some question the accuracy of the numbers when compared to mortality rates from previous years before the pandemic. According to the Office of National Statistics, the spike in fatalities for this year remains significantly higher than the government's official record of COVID fatalities.
Well, let's talk about all of that with Dr. Ranjit Brar. He's an NHS consultant, a physician and surgeon. Good to have you on the show, as always. So let's start with the latest. Today, announced by the government, 981 deaths, more than 50,000 new cases. How bad is it, really?
It's extremely worrying for us. Thank you for having me back with you. I and my colleagues, once again, are in a situation where normal activity of healthcare has theatres to look after ventilated patients in A&E. There's an emergency being declared in Kent, in Essex and Kent, where there are essentially hospitals are unable to take more admissions. There's no ICU bed capacity left across London, Kent, or all much of Essex. We're trying to expand our numbers, but we've got to the point where, once again, really the NHS has been overwhelmed. If you look at the fact that we're unable to meet our normal healthcare needs as a population, and are really facing difficulties even just treating the people who are turning up with this one disease.
And we're looking at some of these numbers, and some of them have beat the numbers that we saw in spring during the first full lockdown. And now there is concern of an unprecedented increase in COVID-19 patients in British hospitals. Tell us what kind of an impact it's going to have on the already underfunded, strained NHS. Are we going to see all those Nightingale hospitals that have remained vastly unused so far being used?
I think not, and I think we found there's a distance between our Nightingale hospitals and, for example, China's response. Our Nightingale hospitals were rolled out. Unfortunately, they were planned only to look at intensive care patients for extra ventilator capacity. In fact, the London Excel Centre has been closed, quietly closed, because they were never able to start it. So it didn't really amount to the Nightingale efforts to any more hospital capacity. You're right, we've got more than 25,000 patients in the hospital with COVID, but that's going towards the 1,000 deaths a day type mark. And yesterday we had in excess of 51,000 cases, which is the largest number ever recorded, test positive cases. So this is not the end of the wave. This is the beginning of this period, and it looks set to get worse. As you quite rightly say, bed capacity in NHS has been halved over the last 20 years. So our ICU rates are from the lowest in Europe, despite our efforts to expand ICU. So we're looking at real problems of a systematically underfunded service that is very much facing extraordinary pressures and under real strain at the moment.
And the last thing you said, you know, people, they were aware of it all happening in 2017, 2016. Doctors, junior doctors in A&E complaining about underfunding and everything else. But let's talk briefly about numbers here and the experience. The government says, you know what, when this is all over, people are going to look back and then judge who has done what in terms of governments around the world handling the pandemic. But maybe compare the British experience with the Chinese experience, or with the South Korean experience.
It's an unmitigated shambles. The United States and Britain, ostensibly two of the richest countries in the world, have unquestionably had the worst response. We had an event, partly right to say, we were aware of it in 2016. We ran a staged response of our initiative to a pandemic, a flu-type pandemic, but a pandemic. 2016 called Operation Cygnus, that was overseen by the then Health Secretary, and that showed that the NHS would fall over in the wake of the pandemic, but you know they were unable to change the direction of policy, which was increasing privatisation, outsource, and decrease of capacity, notwithstanding increase of funding. That funding goes through the NHS to private companies, and there's been a decrease of capacity, decrease of frontline available services to the British staff, the British public, and it's for that reason, for political reasons, that there was a deliberate choice not to prepare for this eventuality, and it's very rich of our government to say that they've been doing very well. Really, if you compare this to China, they're talking about the vaccines in the answer. China did not need a vaccine to eradicate the virus from their population using adequate healthcare measures, where they mobilize the resources and healthcare facilities and put the lives of the people first. Our system has failed. It's failed precisely because it's the profit above the lives of people. And that's left now. The healthcare are underfunded and the league is trying to pick up the pieces.
All right. Dr. Ranjit Brar, thank you as always. And staying in the UK, an overwhelming majority of MPs have passed the Trade and Cooperation and Security Agreement with the European Union. The bill has cleared its first hurdle by 521 votes to 73. The majority of Labour MPs are thought to have voted for it after leader Sir Keir Starmer said a thin deal was better than no deal.
Having taken back control of our money, our borders, our laws, and our waters by leaving the European Union on January the 31st, we now seize this moment to forge a fantastic new relationship with our European neighbours based on free trade and friendly cooperation.
On Friday, the UK and the EU sever ties and begin a new business and security relationship. European leaders have described the agreement as an important milestone. European Union governments also approved a trade deal regulating relations between the 27-nation bloc and the UK, paving the way for its provisional application from January 1st. A vaccine produced by the joint venture between Oxford University and pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca has become the second COVID-19 jab to be approved for UK use. It got the green light from a UK regulatory body earlier today and has shown to be 70% effective, more than 20% less effective than those produced by Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna. The vaccine is expected to be sought by many countries because of its low cost, availability, and ease of use. UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock has said the vaccine was scheduled to be rolled out to British citizens from January 4th. Venezuela has signed a contract with Russia to acquire 10 million doses of the Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, enough to begin the first phase of mass inoculations. In October, 2,000 Venezuelans took part in the vaccine's clinical trials. The country's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, has highlighted the steps taken by the government to free up resources blocked abroad to be used to access the UN vaccination fund. Bank of England is denying Caracas access to more than $1 billion worth of Venezuelan gold held in its vaults. The country is one of the most heavily sanctioned on the world stage, with crippling U.S. sanctions leading to chronic shortages of life-saving medication and other essential items.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Let's see what's been trending on social media. The House of Representatives of the U.S. Congress has voted to increase stimulus checks for Americans to $2,000 a person instead of the original $600. But the proposal stalled in the U.S. Senate. Robert Inlakesh joins me now to tell us who and what got in the way. Robert, good evening.
Well, it seems that at this point, the ongoing war, which it has been termed inside of the Republican Party, is being somewhat won by Mitch McConnell inside of the Senate, as there has been a rejection of Schumer's push to send Trump the bill for $2,000 stimulus payment checks for the average Americans. And of course, Donald Trump came out with this proposal that $600 was not enough for Americans to receive during this time, and that they deserve $2,000, and he pushed it. Nancy Pelosi, inside of the House, put it forth by unanimous consent. It was able to pass. Bernie Sanders was attempting to pressure the Senate to get a vote on this, but it looks like the entire thing has fell apart in its tracks at this point. And it doesn't look likely that it's going to happen at this point, that people are going to get the stimulus checks. And this is in large part to do with the Republicans who are against Donald Trump at the moment, again, on that Mitch McConnell team, if you could call it that, inside of the Republican Party. So it's all to do with this sort of war that's going on within the Republicans. And on top of that as well, many people have been talking about the fact that it's so difficult for them to get $2,000 checks for ordinary Americans who are struggling, hundreds of thousands of people who are going to be kicked out of their homes soon because they cannot make their payments. But when it comes to providing aid to Israel, aid to Egypt, for instance, that's fine. Inside of this bill, $500 million was going to be sent over to Israel. You know, they were advancing checks sent to the military-industrial complex. There has time and time again this year been these bailouts for corporations, which number into the trillions, yet they can't even provide for their own people. The military-industrial complex, yes, wars overseas, yes, and of course projects as well to investigate things like frogs, etc., that they can afford, but not for the American people.
Very good points there. Robert, tell us what people have been thinking.
The first one we've got here commenting on this says, he does not care about us, referring to those who have passed it. He's looking at the bottom line while we starve, our food pantries ran out and closed. What now? How do we feed our children? I'm so sick of my life being in the hands of Republicans. We, the people, need help now. We've got another one here as well saying, so you are telling me he could give Israel $500 million in this bill, but no more than $600 to our own people. Why is it that these scumbags will spend trillions on killing people, but won't spend anything helping us at home? Tired of this, we need a revolution.
Wow. All right, Robert in Lakesh with that story. Robert, thank you. Now, the year 2020 will certainly be remembered as a challenging one across Europe, but perhaps more so by the continent's Muslims. Islamophobia has become a major area of concern as anti-Muslim hate spreads as rapidly as the deadly coronavirus. Robert Carter has been following the rise of the right across Europe this year and sums up a dismal year of hate.
This year will forever be remembered for the spread of COVID-19. But another, arguably more dangerous disease has spread rapidly too, hate. More specifically, hate against Muslims. Some of the most obvious examples can be seen in France, with the French President Emmanuel Macron pushing through anti-Islam legislation to prevent so-called Islamic separatism. In a later speech, the president condemned Islam as a religion in crisis, which radicalizes citizens.
Mais je demande à tout citoyen, quelle que soit sa religion.
And there is, in this radical Islam, since this is what the issue is, let's take it on board and let's name it. There is a will, a demand, an organized method to go against the laws of the Republic and create a parallel order based on the other values, developing a separatist society first off with the goal of ultimately taking total control, and that's what they are doing, gradually, by rejecting the freedom of expression and freedom of thought.
Tensions in France additionally increased when the state publicly began defending insulting caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The row spilled over into violence with attacks against journalists on the 25th of September, a teacher beheaded by a lone wolf Takfiri on the 16th of October, and then on the 18th, two Muslim women wearing hijab were viciously stabbed by attackers screaming, "You dirty Arabs." Outside of France, things aren't much better, with numerous incidents of far-right Quran-burning protests occurring across Scandinavia. Between November 2019 and October 2020, at least four notorious Quran desecration rallies have been allowed, despite the fact that these protests offend millions. The Norwegian Prime Minister even publicly defended Islamophobes' rights to desecrate this holy book back in August. Then there is the Islamophobic ban on the Muslim niqab, a policy enforced by many countries, despite the fact that covering your face has been proven to save lives.
Banning the niqab in France, it can be the opening door, and it's quite ironic that if you don't wear the mask in France, you can be fined, and if you wear the niqab and you're a woman, you can be fined too, which shows you the political hypocrisy that French politicians exhibit. Not oppressed, I'm not suppressed by anyone, but these common stereotypes have been, disseminated by the media, have contributed to the social conditioning of people in a way that whenever they see a Muslim woman who's visibly recognizable as a Muslim woman, they think, oh, she's wearing this because of her husband. And you know what? We need to save her from that, which is a total, rubbish.
Austria has also jumped on the bandwagon, punishing all Muslims for the acts of a small minority of criminals, introducing new laws intended to gag Muslims' freedom of speech.
In the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offense called political Islam in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Across the English Channel, a new conspiracy has been widely circulating, claiming that Muslims are somehow responsible for spreading the coronavirus. These ideas are not supported by any facts. However, the belief was so widespread it had to be debunked by a government fact-checker website. These are just a few examples, but studies suggest that Islamophobia is present at nearly all levels of society. Vaccines are being produced to stop COVID-19, but what is being done to defeat racism against Muslims?
Robert Carter with that story. Let's take you to Bosnia now, where hundreds of refugees have spent the night in buses after an attempt to relocate them failed. These refugees have spent the past week without shelter, heat, or food in freezing temperatures after their temporary tent camp was destroyed in a fire on December 23rd. The camps have been slammed by international officials and aid groups as inadequate for housing refugees. When temperatures dropped even further on Tuesday, buses were sent to pick them up, but the authorities still haven't decided where they'll be taking them. Most of the refugees are staying in the northwest corner of Bosnia, where they hope to cross into Croatia before moving on to more prosperous EU nations. And in this segment, a pro-Trump nurse in the U.S. fired for flashing the white power OK hand signal in a viral TikTok video. Richard Sedan is with me to discuss that story. Richard, tell us what you know.
So this is a very alarming story, Saeed. You and I have become used and we've talked at great length, for example, about the problem of white supremacism in the U.S. police force. And of course, we know it's present in all areas of life. But this first story is about a nurse, I think in the Nebraska area, who basically went viral for flashing a white power symbol on her TikTok account with about 5,000 followers, which then got shared hundreds of thousands of times.
Just saw it right there, Richard, and they're calling her a material danger to non-white patients. Unpack that for us.
Precisely. So a number of questions are raised here. First of all, how did this woman become employed by Rock Medical Group? Rock Medical Group have now terminated the woman's employment, but what safeguards, what mechanisms have they put in place to make sure the problem doesn't happen again if they're serious? And, you know, we've seen, for example, with the police and even in the UK, the UK Armed Forces, we've seen white supremacism at different levels of these institutions. But the question really is, how widespread is this problem now in the United States? Because black people are already dealing with serious conditions of racism. We're in the midst of a pandemic where medical practitioners are already entrusted with people's lives. And so the question is, how widespread is the problem? And I suppose the bigger question is, given the scope of the problem, how have black people and non-white people been affected by potential white supremacists within the medical profession? So a very alarming story, but I think really there are more questions.
Richard, the other question to ask would be like how this will impact the level of trust among the non-white community, if you will, in the medical staff.
Well, this is a problem. There's already often deep mistrust from black communities and non-white communities towards the medical profession for deep-rooted historical but also current reasons. And we've also seen on the 20th of December, Dr. Suzanne Moore, a black physician, she died of COVID-19 on the 20th of December. And she actually articulated the fact that there are alleged many incidences of alleged mistreatment of black people and also black health practitioners. So, you know, this story here might be the tip of the iceberg. One has to question the mind frame of a nurse who would flash
correct.
A white power sign outside right. the operating theater. Quite incredible.
Right. Before you bring us the online reaction, Richard, maybe quickly tell us about this hand signal itself. Has it been around long or is it a recent arrival?
It's fairly recent. It's a couple of years old. In a nutshell, it started out actually as a hoax. From a website online about 2 years ago. But then the hoax gained such traction that far-right white nationalists actually then actually adopted the symbol for themselves. So it's gone from being a hoax to an actual, very visible, prominent symbol of white nationalism.
All right, let's hear what people have had to say about this.
Let's go to a filmmaker, Tariq Nasheed, first of all, who says, when there are hospital nurses throwing up white power hand signs, people shouldn't be surprised that black people have trust issues with the people in the medical field. If we have time, I'll go to Lourdes, who says, the frightening thing is at one time she worked in an intensive care unit in Durham, which has a sizable black population. If she was working in an ICU or cardiac CCU, God only knows the treatment her black patients received. And we have a reaction from MB, who says, there needs to be an investigation of patient records with her name on it. And I've seen several tweets along these lines.
All right, Richard Sedan with that story. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast. Thanks, everyone.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Great hero, General of Hearts. The former commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their eight companions all attained martyrdom on 3rd of January 2020 in an act of terrorism directly ordered by the criminal U.S. President Donald Trump. But what was the purpose of this nefarious act of terrorism on 3rd of January 2020 at Baghdad Airport? For sure, the terrorist act of assassinating the unmatched anti-terrorist hero was in continuation of U.S. hostility against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran. This hostility has continued incessantly for the past 42 years. The Iranian nation's firm resistance in the face of all plots by the global arrogance has been a role model to regional nations and beyond. This public uprising among different nations has horrified the U.S. and the Zionist regime. These nations are seriously indebted to the sincere and selfless efforts of martyrs like Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who totally changed the balance of power in the region. The United States tried for years to destabilize Iran, but in vain. The Daesh terrorist outfit was obliterated by the courageous endeavors of Mahdi Soleimani and his fellow combatants from Iran, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. This great development totally foiled the American conspiracy of disintegrating the region and turning it into a so-called Greater Middle East. The U.S. dispatched thousands of forces to the region under the guise of fighting terrorism, but in practice, it supported terrorism and didn't want to destroy the terrorists, as it was using them as a tool to further its own ends. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The claim of formation of alliance against Daesh is a lie. Although the Americans are opposed to the controlled Daesh, they will confront anyone who wants to really destroy this terrorist Daesh group." Americans created the Daesh terrorist group in 2012 with the aim of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad, the legitimate government in Syria, and taking control of Iraq. But they faced enormous resistance and a roadblock called Qasem Soleimani. This came whilst the Americans waged bloody wars in the region in the name of fighting terrorism. Indeed, they have pillaged the wealth of Arab countries in the region. Donald Trump chose Riyadh for its first trip abroad after entering the White House. This was done with the same motive. He called the Arab regimes as milking cows. He tried to sell weapons and rescue America's bankrupt companies through Iranophobia. Alexander Konyazov, a Russian analyst, has commented on the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. terrorist army. Alexander Konyazov, a top Russian analyst, said, "The fact that ISIL terrorists have been formed in the RAND think tank corporation is a clear and known issue. General Qasem Soleimani was a bulwark, a dam against materialization of Washington's plan to dehumanize the Middle East and then spread it to the other neighboring regions and the entire world. History will be the judge of everyone and everything, but General Qasem Soleimani has in fact turned into a historical figure in his own time." Dear listeners, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani mobilized and organized the resistance front against Takfiri terrorists, which were created and supported by the United States, the Zionist regime of Israel, and Saudi Arabia. The assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani was a turning point in the history of the region and the beginning of the end of U.S. hegemony in West Asia. American analyst Noam Chomsky says, "Instability is an interesting concept in the political discourse. When Iran helps the Iraqi government and Kurdistan in defense against ISIL terrorists, this measure is described as instability. But when the United States attacks Iraq and kills hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, displaces millions of people, destroys the country, and initiates sectarian clashes to disintegrate Iraq and disturb the entire region, and spread terrorism in the entire world, it is called a part of the American mission for stabilizing, which we should continue for the benefit of the world. The United States has breached and overtrodden international principles of law for the benefit of the Zionist regime of Israel and safeguarding its illegitimate interests in West Asia region. Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Amin Hatami, says the assassination of top general, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, was carried out with the aim of resuscitating U.S. presence in the region and undermining Iran's regional influence and deterrence power. Brigadier General Amir Hatami said, "The people's presence in the scene and the IRGC's missile response annihilated the mock awe of the United States and the system of arrogance and proved Iran's defense power and might to the entire world." Najah Muhammad Ali, an Iraqi expert in international affairs, said, "Donald Trump's assassination of great general Mahdi Soleimani was a big mistake, and he fell in a trap that had been prepared for getting rid of him." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Thwarting all U.S. illegitimate designs for West Asia was an example of Mahdi Soleimani's bravery and courage." The leader added, "Americans tried to cast the issue of Palestine into oblivion and put the Palestinians in the weak position so that they would not dare to struggle. But this great man filled the hands of the Palestinians and gave them the courage and ability to struggle. The failure of the heavy and aggressive operation of the Zionists against Gaza in the recent years is a reality that has caused a nightmare for the United States and the leadership of the Zionist regime."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
An important point in this respect is that regarding the domestic issues of the country, well, most comments about him are about his regional battles and activities. Shahid Soleimani did not belong to any party and faction, but at the same time, he was a revolutionary in the complete sense of the word. The revolution and being revolutionary were his definite red lines. Some people should not try to undermine this aspect of his personality. This is a reality about him. He was absorbed by the revolution, and being a revolutionary was his red line. Of course, he was not interested in aligning himself with different parties, different factions, and the like, but he was completely committed to the idea of being a revolutionary. He was committed to the revolution and to the auspicious and dazzling guidelines of our late Imam, may God bestow paradise on him.
Your light and love, all I see. a thing or I'd ever want to meet. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
One example of his insight and his courage was that the enemies might know this well, but some friends might not know it, is that he managed to foil all illegitimate plots of the Americans in West Asia with the help of regional peoples, or it could be said with the support that he offered to them. That man managed to stand up to all the plots that had been hatched with money, with vast propaganda efforts made by the Americans, with the diplomatic capabilities of the Americans, and with the bullying that they exert on politicians, particularly on some weak countries. He managed to foil all the schemes set up by them in West Asia. Regarding Palestine, the Americans intended to consign the issue of Palestine to oblivion and to keep the Palestinians weak so that they would not dare speak of fighting. But that man empowered the Palestinians. He did something to make a small region like the Gaza Strip, which is a small strip of land, stand up to the Zionist regime despite all their extravagant claims. He created such a disastrous situation for them that they asked for ceasefire after just 48 hours. This was done by Haj Qasem Soleimani.
Alhamdulillah, praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? Or as US President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
In the limelight.
President Trump recently tweeted that the Justice Department and the FBI have done nothing about the 2020 presidential election voter fraud, followed by these more ominous lines. Never give up. See everyone in D.C. on 6th of January. The unmistakable reference is to the day Congress will count the Electoral College's votes, with Vice President Mike Pence presiding. Mr. Trump is leaning on the vice president and congressional allies to invalidate the November election by throwing out duly certified votes for Joe Biden. The article you're about to hear has been written by Neil K. Cathill and John Monsky. The piece is titled, Will Pence Do the Right Thing? Neil Cathill is a law professor at Georgetown University and a former acting Solicitor General of the United States. John Monsky is a board member of the New York Historical Society. The article has been taken from the New York Times. President Donald Trump recently tweeted that the Justice Department and FBI have done nothing about the 2020 presidential election voter fraud, followed by these more ominous lines. Never give up. See everyone in D.C. on 6th of January. The unmistakable reference is to the day Congress will count the Electoral College's votes, with Vice President Mike Pence presiding. Mr. Trump is leaning on the vice president and congressional allies to invalidate the November election by throwing out duly certified votes for Joe Biden. Mr. Pence thus far has not said he would do anything like that, but his language is worrisome. Last week he said, "We're going to keep fighting until every legal vote is counted. We're going to win Georgia. We're going to save America," as a crowd screamed, "Stop the steal." And some Republicans won't let up. On Monday, Representative Louie Gohmert of Texas and other politicians filed a frivolous lawsuit which has multiple fatal flaws in both form and substance, in an attempt to force the vice president to appoint pro-Trump electors. President Donald Trump himself has criticized virtually everyone's view of the election, from that of the Supreme Court to the FBI to Senator Mitch McConnell. But he has never attacked Mr. Pence, suggesting he has hopes for the vice president. But as a matter of constitutional text and history, any effort on 6th of January is doomed to fail. It would also be profoundly anti-democratic and unconstitutional. Both Article 2 of the Constitution and the 12th Amendment say that the votes of the Electoral College are to be opened by the President of the Senate, meaning the Vice President. The Electoral Count Act passed in 1887 to avoid chaotic counts like the one that followed the 1876 election adds important details. It provides a detailed timeline to tabulate electoral votes, culminating with a final count to take place on 6th of January, and it delineates the powers of the Vice President. He is to be the presiding officer, meaning he is to preserve order and decorum, open the ballot envelopes, provide those results to a group of tellers, call for any objection by members of Congress, announce the results of any votes on objections, and ultimately announce the result of the vote. Nothing in either the text of the Constitution or the Electoral Count Act gives the Vice President any substantive powers. His powers are ministerial, and that circumscribed role makes general sense. The whole point of an election is to let the people decide who will rule them. If an incumbent could simply maneuver to keep himself in office, after all, a maneuver to protect Mr. Trump also protects Mr. Pence. The most foundational concept about government would be gravely undermined. In America, we the people, not we the Vice President, control our destiny. The drafters of the Electoral Count Act consciously insisted on this weakened role for the Vice President. They guarded against any pretense he might have to throw out a particular state's votes, saying that the Vice President must open all certificates and papers purporting to be electoral votes. They further said, in the event of a dispute, both chambers of Congress would have to disagree with a particular state's slate of electoral votes to reject them. And they made it difficult for Congress to disagree, adding measures such as a safe harbor provision and deference to certification by state officials. In this election, certification is clear. There are no ongoing legal challenges in the states of any merit whatsoever. All challenges have lost, spectacularly and often in the courts of law. The states and the electors have spoken their will. Neither Vice President Mike Pence nor the loyal followers of President Donald Trump have a valid basis to contest anything. To be sure, this structure creates awkwardness as it forces the Vice President to announce the result even when personally unfavorable. After the close election of 1960, Richard Nixon, the Vice President at the time, counted the votes for his opponent, John F. Kennedy. Al Gore, in perhaps one of the more dramatic moments of our Republic's short history, counted the votes and reported them in favor of George W. Bush. Watching Al Gore count the votes, shut off all challengers and deliver the presidency to Mr. Bush was a powerful moment in our democracy. By the time he counted the votes, America and the world knew where he stood. And we were all lifted up when Al Gore, at the end, asked God to bless the new president and vice president and joined the chamber in applause. Republican leaders, including Senators Mitch McConnell, Roy Blunt, and John Thune, have recognized the outcome of the election, despite the president's wrath. Mitch McConnell put it in clear terms. The Electoral College has spoken, so today I want to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden. Notably, Mr. Pence has been silent. He has not even acknowledged the historic win by Kamala Harris, the nation's first female, first African-American and first Asian-American vice president. He now stands on the edge of history as he begins his most consequential act of leadership. The question for Vice President Mike Pence, as well as other members of Congress, is which side of history he wants to come down on. Can he show the integrity demonstrated by every previous presidential administration? The American people accept a graceful loser, but a sore loser never goes down well in the history books. We urge Mike Pence to study our first president. After a Revolutionary War, the artist Benjamin West reported that King George of England had asked him what General Washington would do now that America was independent. Benjamin West said that Washington would give up power and go back to farming. King George responded with words to the effect that if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. Indeed, Washington did so, surrendering command to the Army of Congress and returning to Mount Vernon for years until he was elected president. And he again relinquished power 8 years later, even though many would have been happy to keep him president for life. George Washington, in this way, fully realized the American Republic, because there is no republic without the peaceful transfer of power. And it's now up to Mike Pence to recognize exactly that. Like all those that have come before him, he should count the votes as they have been certified and do everything he can to oppose those who would do otherwise. This is no time for anyone to be a bystander. Our republic is under line.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're going to be discussing the documentary Drone, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Tonya Hessen-Schei. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Roby, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph and Radio 4's film programme, and Dan Blaisbrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, Drone is about the ultimate weapon in the war on terror. Through a mixture of original interviews, archive material, and simulations, Schei reveals crucial information about the workings of the covert CIA drone war, which the film argues has revolutionized killing, has turned war into a video game, and has had a devastating impact on human life in places such as Pakistan.
Imagine killing more than 1,500 enemies in war without ever stepping foot on the battlefield.
We are at war with an organization that would kill as many Americans as they could if we did not stop them first.
The drones have changed everything. It's the defining weapon of the war on terror.
It's never been easier for an American president to carry out a killing operation at the ends of the earth.
We are safer because of our efforts. These strikes have saved lives.
I didn't really understand what it meant to kill at first. We sat in a box. We were the ultimate peeping toms.
You never know who you're killing because you never actually see a face.
1,626 people were killed in the operations that I took part of.
How many of them do you think were innocent?
I'm the only one that really is vocal about it. It just blows my mind.
War is an unbelievably profitable business.
The military has invested in video games as recruiting tools.
How do we find our 18X pilots? How do we identify these people early?
I had no idea what I was in for. I wasn't even 20 years old at that point.
Dozens of highly skilled Al-Qaeda operatives have been taken off the battlefield.
The United States is violating one of the most fundamental rights of all, the right to life.
The truth is, the vast majority of people have no earthly idea what's happening here.
It is not justifiable killing unarmed, innocent civilians.